This episode may contain explicit language. Welcome to Care and Feeding, the show where we parent together. I'm Elizabeth Newcamp. I write the family travel blog Dutch Dutch Goose. I'm the mom of three littles, Henry who's 12, Oliver who's 9, and Teddy who's 7. We live in Tokyo, Japan.
I'm Zach Rosen. I make another podcast. It's called The Best Advice Show. And I'm dad to 6-year-old Noah and 3-year-old Ami. We live in Detroit, Michigan.
Hi, I'm Lucy Lopez. I host the Mamacita Rica podcast. I'm mother to Amelia, who's 13, Avery, 11, and we live in Miami.
Today on the show, we're talking about polyamory and parenting. Jess Daylover and her metamour, Ash, are co-hosts of the Remodeled Love podcast, and they'll join me to talk all about parenting in a polyamorous family. We'll also share a round of recommendations, and then if you're in the Slate Plus Club, Jess and Ash stick around for a game of parenting yays and nays. Here's what you'll hear if you have Slate Plus. Okay, here comes a very divisive.
Oh, Lordy.
All right. Telling children the truth about Santa Claus and other holiday figures from a young age is more honest and beneficial.
Yeah. Yes. I absolutely agree with that. And guess what? I'm a hypocritical POS because I, again, thought I was going to be the crunchy mom that was like, we don't lie to our kids because then they are heartbroken later when they found out you lied to them and it's not real. And then I saw the magic and the joy of them getting into the story and I have completely bought into it. And so I think what I'm doing is wrong. And I'm doing it, just so everyone knows. And Ash refuses to do it. And so Ash has had to walk this.
How does that work?
I will let her tell you.
It's called semantics.
If you're listening on Slate Plus, thank you so much for your support. We'll catch you later for your exclusive segment. If you're not listening on Slate Plus, we hope you'll consider it. There's no better way to support the show. And when you're a member, you'll also get ad-free listening on all Slate podcasts. Sounds great, right? We think so too. Go to slate.com/careplus for more info, or you can just subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts for a little less money. The choice is yours. All right, we're going to take a quick break, but we'll see you back here in a minute. We're back, and it's time for my interview with Jess and Ash of the Remodeled Love podcast. So just to get everyone on the same page, Jess and her husband have 2 children, but they're polyamorous. So those 4 also live with Jess's boyfriend and her husband's girlfriend, Ash. Together, they make up a polycule, basically one big blend of a chosen family members.
Incredible.
I do want to urge listeners to put whatever they think they know about polyamory to the side and just let Jess and Ash explain how things are working in their family, because fundamentally, they're actually doing what so many of us desire to do, which is build a healthy, loving family. Right. So with that, here's my discussion with Jess and Ash. I think the best place to start is a brief overview of what polyamory looks like for you guys currently. So like, who's in the house? How does it work practically? Just kind of giving us a, that for people that don't know you, the like window into your world of the current family structure.
So my disclaimer before describing our polycule is always that polyamory looks different for everybody. So if you do not know any polyamorous people in your life and you've never heard of polyamory, don't know how it works, please understand that we are just one tiny type of way that you can do polyamory. This does not represent the entire culture at all. So in our polycule is me and my husband. We have been together for 14 years and married for 10. Polyamorous for 10. We became polyamorous months before we got married, actually. And our 6-year-old and our 3-year-old and my metamour, Ash, on the call with us. People don't like the term sister wives. We use it as a joke,
sister wife, but okay.
We like sister wives, and that's how we are in each other's phones. But there's a lot of cultural weight to that term, so we don't use it. And my boyfriend is who lives in our home.
And how... Like, if you just had to describe how parenting works for you guys, is everybody parenting? Are there primary parents? Are there, like, that's like a very complicated question simplified. But is there a way that you can kind of, like, are you working as a team all the time? Are there primary and secondary parents?
Yeah. Well, we are definitely navigating the interesting waters of a blended family that I think anybody out there who has gone through divorce and then remarried, and the, like, what role does the step parent play in decision making? And is that fair? And you know, the very difficult journey for the step parent. Mm-hmm. So I'll give my answer and then I'll let Ash kind of play off of that. So from my point of view, we have a really unique situation in which we very much are still have a primary parenting setup in a way that I think is efficient, but also has a painful side, especially to Ash. And my partner is much more of a fun uncle. So he is, well, but he's also very much a dad. Mm-hmm. Like, let's be for real, you know, like those kids are wrapped around his little finger. But, you know, he maintains his autonomy, right? So he can do whatever he wants after work. You know, there's no expectation that he's home, but I can call upon him to help if I need it. If he gets overstimulated or tired or is sick with the flu, he can be up in his room and he can sleep the entire 3 days and never once have to parent. And so he maintains his autonomy and his boundaries. In an interesting way, he's also not super confident in his parenting abilities. And so I think he maintains a little bit more of a, he shows up the best way that he can. Whereas I would say Ash is much more of another mom in a, you know, stepmother, blended mother, you know, bonus mom type of way. But I also know the hierarchy present also stands in the way of that for them. So I'll kind of let you go from there.
Yeah, I think I would say that as far as of the four of us, I think Jess, Joe, and myself do more of like what you would maybe think of as like traditional parenting as far as the role, with me having less time for sure, a little bit less say in decision making, which is honestly like how I would expect. And I think even when I came in from the very beginning, I was like, hey, like, even if they were to want to, that's not something I would have wanted, because that takes time as far as like building up, you know, rapport with each other, building up like your collaboration chops with the specific family dynamic that you're jumping into. And my background is being a nanny too. So there's like some crossover and some similarity. And then also there's just, you know, the very important piece of like your bond with the children, just like being a child care provider, like that takes time. So it's not just something that I would feel comfortable like jumping in on and trying to be like some 100%, I'm your new mama.
like, here I am.
type thing. So, you know, we've just kind of ebbed and flowed with different setups depending on like all the different relationships involved and depending on comfortability of everyone. So it has ended up looking very different in different seasons for sure.
Jess, you talk on Instagram too about how Ash like sometimes almost knows what to do more. I feel like you have some videos where you're like, she actually has this sense of parenting or sense of what to do in these situations that sometimes you don't. Is that a fair characterization?
Well, I will be the first to tell you Ash is a better mom than me. And they like to roll their eyes at that a little bit. And I am saying it to be, you know, to bring you in on it's a storytelling tactic, right? But I also fully stand behind it and I can give you my theory on that. First of all, you know, Ash came in, you know, we had just survived living in a nuclear family with a toddler and a medically complex newborn in a pandemic, completely isolated from any help. So by the time Ash entered the picture, she just had more spoons. If anyone's this a spoony, you know, have spoons, yes, has
more energy, more capacity,
was less burnt out. That is one huge piece of it that Ash is the first person to remind me of every time I say you're better than them. And I'm never, ever saying it from a pitiful, poor me, martyry place. I'm always saying it from a grateful, cheeky place. Secondly, so they have more bandwidth, they are less burnout. Secondly, you know, when you birth your kids, they are literally your biological product. They mirror you. They show you your deepest wounds and your shadows and the epigenetic trauma that you have passed on. You know, so my kids trigger me in a way that they do not trigger Ash, and therefore Ash is able to maintain her balance in situations where I might really be forced to move into my stuff. Not saying that does not happened to her, because I think the universe is still bringing you stepchildren, adopted children, whatever, village children that are still there to show you a piece of yourself. But it's just, it doesn't hit quite the same. It's like when you're able to maintain your regulation when you're taking care of another kid versus your own kid. Like, they just don't lose their regulation maybe as quickly as I do. And then the third reason that I say Ash is a better mom than me is because they just literally have more parenting knowledge, and it is a much more of a passionate thing for them. So they have studied parenting stuff growing up. And so we believe in collaborative, gentle parenting. That is our parenting philosophy, all our entire household. And they literally just have more education in that. And so, yes, there is hierarchy when it comes to final decisions for our kids, but we are truly simpatico. So it might not be that Ash can make the final decision, but very rarely, because like Ash will call us in, my husband and I will call us in and say, hey, I'm seeing you guys do this in your parenting, and I don't think that's in alignment with how you guys want to be parenting. It doesn't feel good to me. It's not working for the kids. This is what I'm seeing, and this is where I think you should improve. Or this is a decision I think we should make. If it were, you know, my bio kids, I would make this decision. And we're like, you know what? You're right. Let's do that.
Yeah. I also think that's something that like we all kind of do with each other. And that's one thing I really like about this co-parenting dynamic with all four of us, is that there's no qualms about kind of gently stepping in, especially if you see someone like acting, you know, out of alignment with like what their ideals are or what they have expressed for that season, like their goals are. And especially if it's something that is like maybe negatively impacting themselves or, you know, the household. So I think, you know, there are times where I'm like not as chill as I want to be, and just like just kind of like steps in.
Other parents, Ash.
I love it because Ash is the definitely the more gentle parent. And just like I said, because like my husband and I will think that we are successfully gentle parenting, and simply because Ash has more education on gentle parenting, collaborative parenting, will point out, actually, that's not what you're doing. Actually, you are enforcing a consequence and you're manipulating them through emotional manipulation, but you think you're not, you know? And so
yeah,
there's just more experience there. It's such a blessing.
How did those conversations go without hurt feelings? Because I mean, I think that's, I would say when I look at like questions that listeners write in, right? Like we get a lot about what to do when your partner is doing something like handling a parenting situation you don't like, or a friend is handling a parent situation you don't like. And I do know that what I see here, and of course what I see on Instagram and get through the book as well, is this idea of like, you're in a loving relationship, the entire family. And so it's when you know that advice is coming from that place, it's easier to take. But it seems like you guys have a lot as a family of like communication has to be really high in this situation. So how are you setting aside time to have these conversations? Are you pulling people aside? Like, how does this go when someone is parenting a way that it, Ash, like you said, doesn't meet their goals?
I think that this, as far as like how you pull someone aside or how it looks like, it has looked like and continues to look like different things. So earlier on, we used to have really consistent weekly meetings, like family meetings, where we would go over a lot of different things, like where each person each adult would check in with, you know, how are you doing as an individual? How are you doing in the relationship? How's the household stuff going? Kind of from like a administrative place and like, how is the parenting stuff going? So we like reevaluate, and there would be like a space to share like successes, concerns, curiosities. And I think at this point, we don't have as much of the weekly family meetings, even though we want to get back to them, but we have developed a dynamic where we can either say something in the moment that's really quick, and we trust each other, and we take a lot of time to build trust. So for the most part, it's not like a, how dare you say I'm parenting like this? Like, you need to butt out. Like, there's not, actually, that's never happened. For the most part, like, even if it's something that like someone disagrees with to some extent in the moment, I think we're really good at taking a step back and then regrouping later and having a more like in-depth conversation and checking in. We use a lot of nonviolent communication techniques from Marshall Rosenberg. We're not perfect at it for sure. But it's just a way of approaching conversations where it kind of takes some of the defensiveness and the offensiveness out of communicating and getting to like the root of the matter as far as what your needs are, and also getting to what you're seeing and observing, and fostering more understanding for each other.
Yeah, we just live with an extremely high level of emotional intelligence. And to be polyamorous, you really have to have a high level of emotional intelligence if you're going to thrive and to do it well. And so I have spent the last decade working through core wounds, attachment things, inner child stuff that prevented me from practicing nonviolent communication, prevented me from taking feedback, where I was always operating from ego, operating from wounding. The second that you tell me something about myself that I feel shame about, I'm going to move into one of my control dramas where I'm going to deflect or turn it around on you or get defensive, or I'm going to move into my rejection sensitivity and start, you know, manipulating or playing games or playing the victim or being butthurt in order to feel powerful and get control back in the situation. And it takes a lot of work to get here, because you do have to work through those core wounds. It's a lot of therapy, it's a lot of coaching, it's a lot of education. But then once you get there, we gentle parent our kids and we gentle parent each other.
Yeah, I mean, I think so often we do this with our kids, or we're willing to do it with our kids, but it's a lot harder to do it with like ourselves and our partners. So I think, you know, one of the things that's so interesting to me about the polyamorous relationship is like, you have to, I mean, Jessica, like you said, what other choice do you have? you want to be in this loving relationship with these other adults and these children. Like, you are going to have to learn to communicate effectively.
Yeah. And I would say, like, if you want a healthier dynamic, because the one slight disagreement I have is like, I don't think you have to be highly emotional intelligent to be polyamorous. I know lots of people who aren't, but I think definitely for the type of dynamic that I want, which is like healthier feeling to me, less stressful, less chaotic, less like toxicity, requires a high amount of emotional intelligence.
This leads nicely into this kind of a discussion about the polycule. Am I pronouncing that right? Because in your book, you write this beautiful thing that I pulled out because it's lovely. Like, however, the definition of polycule seems relegated to relationships that involve sex, romance, or other forms of intense connection beyond friendship. But for us, our polycule is defined by our inner circle, our close friends, those who opt into being a significant part of our children's lives, and those with whom we survive capitalism and parenthood by forming daycare and childcare cooperatives. And now, of course, that has, I know your family situation has also evolved since you've written that. But I read this with such, like, even as a monogamous parent, I feel like this is what I'm always striving to create, is this community of people who are here for me and my children, based in this foundation of love, right? That we all love and respect each other. It just seems like such a wonderful way to parent, like it takes a village in the most like loving encapsulated form. I would love some examples of how that plays out in your family and the advantages that you guys see from having this really curated polycule.
What a great line to pull out. And remind me to talk about the app that I'm building to help folks find, build, and sustain their village. Because that's probably the biggest thing that I'm doing right now that I would want your listeners to know about. I think my answer to that question is, well, and it leads into something that might be a little too much for this podcast, but once you get into polyamory, you're just one degree away from discovering something called relationship anarchy, which is not attached to polyamory. You can be a monogamous relationship anarchist, but relationship anarchy is when you really start to question the cultural imperative that, you know, romantic love is the thing that you should strive for in your life. And when you do find a romantic partner, you should be sexually and romantically exclusive with them. And that relationship should sit on top of a pyramid where it is the most important relationship in your life. And everything below that is less important. So you're always putting your romantic sexual relationship first and everything else is below that. But what we actually find in relationship anarchy, and definitely, you know, in polyamory, some of us, is that, well, what does it even mean to be a partner? Because my, you know, most trustworthy long-term relationships are with my girlfriends, my best friends, right?
Absolutely.
This is right. Yeah. And so we're starting to see a little bit of a cultural shift where we're starting to question, well, should we decenter romantic relationships from our lives? Should we be focusing on all these other relationships that are going to be there for you in and out of your season? Whereas most 50% of marriages end up in divorce, you know? And so once you start to really, well, what is a polycule? And is it really just the person I'm having sex with or have a crush on, or we cuddle sometimes, especially when you start to factor in demisexual or asexual relationships? So plot twist, my husband and I have migrated into a non-sexual dynamic. We no longer have sex. That is not on the table for us, but we are still very much partnered in love. That is without a doubt my husband till the end of time. And to circle back to your question, once you start to question these very fuzzy lines, these are borders that we made up, right? All borders in the world, geographical borders are just made up lines that somebody was like, right here. And so once you start to question one border, they all get kind of fuzzy. And then what you have is a village of people. So when my child is crying, who do you need right now? So my kids call Ash sis, because that's what she and I call each other. And then very quickly, they wanted to call her that and they want her to call them that. So, you know, do you want mommy? Do you want sis? Do you want daddy? Do you want Dr. M? Dr. M is my partner. He is anonymous on my platform. Who do you want? Who do you need right now? And who feels safest to you right now? And if one of those parents is tapped out, if we don't have it to give, if I cannot hold space for whatever you're going through right now, can I tag out and tag somebody else in? So to answer your question, the benefit is that the burden of raising children in this hellscape is spread out amongst more people. Because I'm sorry, but the ratio of raising kids needs to be at least 3 to 1. Like, at least for an autistic person like me, who is already overstimulated and burnt out from being a full-time working mom, I have my own chronic health issues going on. And so in order to do this, people need to be able to lean on each other. And kids also need to have can benefit from having a non-hierarchical relationship to other adults in their home. So I've been told before, you know, by a friend of mine that it would wreck her if she ever heard her child call someone else mom. And I was like, man, because that makes me drop to my knees in gratitude that there's another human being that wants to call, that my child wants to call mom. And it's just a difference in wiring. So
I think that's wonderful. What are some of the common misconceptions about polyamory and parenting that you would want to address?
Oh boy. Well, for some reason, according to the internet and my TikTok commenters, yeah. People just, because it triggers something so deep inside of people who haven't been poly educated or anything like that, it, you know, people think polyamory is all about sex. And for some people, it is. That's a huge piece of polyamory for them. For other people, it's a normal amount of sex. And for other people, there's no sex involved at all. There's a lot of asexual polyamorous people, just saying. So people get really, really uncomfortable that I don't know. People think, oh, so they're having orgies in their living room while their kids are upstairs or something like that. Like, we're still just really good parents. We have normal boundaries that normal people, normal healthy people would have around, or like people assume that we are, first of all, that sex is not appropriate and the sex being had is not appropriate. And also that we're introducing our kids to partners who are then leaving every 2 weeks. And, yeah. We are not really that different than someone who is monogamous, got divorced, and is now out in the dating world and maybe has a 6-month wait until a partner can meet their kids, or it's just an emotional milestone that needs to be met. So people automatically project that polyamorous parents do not have boundaries that for some reason they project that monogamous people do have. They just assume that we don't have it. It's super frustrating and also offensive.
Yeah. And like we have like spoken guidelines as far as, you know, people meeting our kids, and then kind of, I think we're just like all on the same page for unspoken things too. Like none of the four of us are bringing in any new person like within the first few months of that person being in our lives, because not from a safety perspective, I'm not dating someone who I don't think is safe for my kids. Like that's just a no go. So I don't, that particular thing that comes up is really confusing for me. I'm yeah. Like, why would I be safe with that person if I think that they're unsafe for my kids? Right. But then I think just from, and then there's this other piece where it's like, in your daily life, as you're like navigating throughout the world, like your kids come into contact with their greater community. And we have people who are our neighbors, and the next year they're not our neighbors. Like we have like kids who go to school with you, but then they left the next like semester. Like in some ways, there's this like flow of relationships that happens. I think what's most important is that the primary people in your kid's life, namely the parents, are stable, like and healthy and doing their best to work through things. It's not as like, because what does that say about military families or traveling artists, right? Like, are all of their kids messed up? Like, no.
Right. I mean, people like to make things out of everything. I mean, I think that was one of the reasons, you know, we really wanted to have this conversation, was just to be able to say, look at what this looks like. And I mean, Jess, that's one of the reasons I love your Instagram account, is sort of like, look at what we're dealing with. And so much of it is similar to what, you know, a monogamous or a different kind of blended family. But there's also these other things that are, you know, specific to polyamory. But there's, I think they don't carry any like different weight than the kind of specific things that happen in a monogamous marriage, right? Like, or in a monogamous relationship, or in a, you're a single parent, all of those carry with them their own kind of challenges.
Yeah, totally. And for some reason, people just get really, they don't understand that they're triggered on polyamory, and that trigger has like negated the critical thinking. And then they don't realize they're projecting, and they don't realize their projections contain a bias inherently. So let's take, for example, one of the questions we get the most. So you're just bringing partners in and out of your kids' life that would devastate them, that would make them feel unstable, and that would hurt them because they're going to lose connections. And so, first of all, this question contains the belief that polyamorous relationships are going to fail. And so because someone has not unpacked their mononormativity, their belief that anything that is not monogamous cannot possibly last, the question automatically assumes certainly your polyamorous relationships are going to end with a breakup, and then your kids will be harmed by that. Secondly, it assumes that even if there were a breakup, because of course we no longer attach the sustainability of a relationship to the success. Sometimes karma runs its course. Sometimes I have learned to break up with people while we are still in love, because you come to realize this is no longer serving our highest good, and I think that we should end this relationship. But it assumes that just because you break up with someone, that person can't have a relationship with your kid. So when people say, so you're just bringing people in and out of your kids' life, and that's going to create instability. Well, if Ash and Joe, my husband, broke up, Ash would not exit my children's lives. There might be a denesting that happens that divorced people also have to work through. But when you have emotionally intelligent, communicative, and you have a village, when you have a village, it's not the weight of that rupture isn't felt so much. And then that relationship, they can still have the relationship just, but I think a lot of times the semiology that monogamous people have is, well, when this relationship ends, it ends badly. And now we're going to play games with each other. We're going to weaponize our children. It's going to be toxic and dysfunctional. So there's no way that I would allow someone who was not a biological parent to continue having a relationship with my kid because it ended badly. That's another assumption that's happening. And the third assumption is that it's negative for relationships to end, when actually your children are going to experience a lot of relationships that end, as Ash laid out, whether it's a best friend moving because they're in a their family's in the military, or you are in a toxic work environment, or you have a friendship that has taken a turn. Teaching your kids to recognize the signs of a relationship that has run its course and being able to consciously and lovingly de-escalate or draw new boundaries or straight up end that relationship is actually a really positive thing. We live on Earth. Death happens here. Death happens literally with our animals, with people we love. It happens in relationships. It happens to systems and cultures. And death is always happening. And so part of this journey is about being death positive and seeing the end of relationships as something that you need to learn to consciously do. Just like you need to teach your kids about sex, you need to teach your kids about death, and that includes relationships.
Yeah, and modeling that. I am sure that there are people listening that have a lot more questions, so I want to take a second to talk about your book, Polyamory and Parenthood. My pitch for this book is, if you've listened to this and wondered, like, how did they use the dating apps? How did this start? When did they decide to be polyamorous? How do you tell the kids and how do you tell the kids? Jess has written all of that in a book. If you are at all curious, you should go take a look at it. I mean, I just think it is a really eye-opening glance at what polyamory looks like, again, for you guys. And you do a great job of saying, like, this is how we come into this with these biases and this system. Do you want to give your elevator pitch for the book as well?
Sure. Well, there are three ways to get our book. You can get it as a just an ebook, a PDF at remodeledlove.com and click on book. And that's actually a pay what you can. So that's a mutual aid pricing. So you can pay as little as $5 and up to $50. And so if you have more resources, we ask you to pay more in order to supplement those who have less. You can also order it in print on Amazon and through Kindle on Amazon. And we are working on the audiobook that is also coming.
That's amazing. And where can people find/follow you?
So Instagram, TikTok, Remodeled Love, website, remodeledlove.com. We're on Facebook and Twitter too, but it's not a super used platform. We also have a podcast, which is just, my background is in radio. And so, having a podcast that is actually popular and gets listened to is a deeply satisfying thing. And it's really fun because you go on the journey. It starts, I am like 8-7 months pregnant with our second child. We start this podcast. We start telling our polyamorous story. You go on this journey with us of struggling, going through heartache and breakups and meeting new people and all of these, all these growth things. And then, you get to witness, Joe announces that he has met this person named Ash, and that Ash is coming to visit. And then, I meet my partner, Dr. M. And so it's, it's quite a journey. So that's just Remodeled Love on all listening platforms.
Also, I don't know how we can throw it in or edit it in. Nuclear Fusion app.
Thanks, sis. I am building the app that I need. So it was something I tossed out to my platform semi as like just a good idea. There should be an app where people who are seeking connections and seeking to build villages and networks of mutual aid and care can meet each other. And people were, and I was like, I want to call it Nuclear Fusion because it's the fusioning of nuclear families and individuals. It's not just for people with kids. And people are like, wow, this is a really good idea. You should actually do this. And so I was like, okay, I'll do a Kickstarter. We'll never get it funded. And we certainly did. We absolutely surpassed that goal last summer. And so we are currently in phase 2 of our build of our app, Nuclear Fusion. It takes a village. is the slogan. And the mission is to help folks find, build, and sustain their village. So not only will the algorithm introduce you anonymously to other people in your area who are individuals, families looking to build networks of care. We want to decommodify care. So the things you find on care.com that you got to go pay for, we're hoping to help people return to the village in the way that it used to be. So not only will we help introduce you to people in your area who have these same values, we will also have an entire educational arm that's teaching you the emotional intelligence tools, the communication tools, and all of the wisdom that has always existed, you know, in indigenous tribes of how to live communally and how to care for each other communally. So that's on the way. We're currently fundraising for phase three, which is the coding, which is our biggest, this is our biggest push right now.
I'm sure.
So nuclearfusionapp.com has that information.
As always, listeners, we want to hear from you. Have you thought about polyamory or other unusual co-parenting setups? Let us know by emailing careandfeedingpod@slate.com or by leaving us a voicemail at 646-357-9318. We're always curious to know what you think. We're going to take one more break and we'll see you back here for recommendations. All right. Let's move on to recommendations. Lucy, what are you recommending?
I'm recommending everybody go out to their backyard if possible and start growing some stuff.
All right.
Nice. My daughters and I are currently growing some jasmine, basil, thyme. I don't know what this flower is called in English because I only know it because it was my grandmother's favorite and she used to call it Santo Domingo's. And Santo Domingo is also another name for the Dominican Republic because she knows that those flowers are from there. So whatever, they're like little flat and they're usually white or pink. Anyways, we're growing that kind of stuff. But then I thought, well, for people who may have, you know, like littles, like little kids, I highly suggest to go into kindercare.com. There's an entire article about five easy edible things your kids can grow and beyond. And you can start growing them like right now and they'll be ready by next month. And we have tomatoes, carrots, you know, stuff that you can see grow and it can be a really great experience between you and your child. Totally check it out. I don't know. I'm big on gardening. I come from a family of farmers from Cuba. So this is like big in our house. And if I can encourage anybody to go out there and touch some grass, as a 13-year-old says every once in a while, please do so. Yeah.
Yes.
And all you need is a sunny window. You can grow a nice couple few things, even if you don't have a yard.
And I've got kids, you know, my 13-year-old and 11-year-old, which you would think they would kind of like not be into it. Their favorite thing is getting popsicle sticks, writing what we're growing on it, making it all decorative. Like it's a big to-do in my casa. So yeah, big recommendation.
What a great spring recommendation.
So much fun. Yeah.
And jasmine. I love that you're doing jasmine. That's so enchanted.
You should see outside, it smells so good at night.
I want to grow jasmine.
Oh, and we also have lavender because of the mosquitoes.
Yeah.
Wow.
That helps.
100%. 100%.
Huh. Lavender and lemongrass, right?
Yes, lavender and lemongrass. We have lavender. We have to be careful with the dog that he doesn't bite at it. But I mean, I live out in the swamp. Miami is a swamp. It's crazy out here. But the mosquitoes are the size of small horses. But the lavender have been keeping them away. So yeah, just thought I'd throw that in there. Anybody who's got that green thumb in them, now is the time to use it.
Love it. Zach, what are you recommending?
I've long talked about bridge songs on this show, songs that might be... you know, if your kids are just into kids music, songs that might kind of get them to stretch out a bit and get excited about adult songs. And, you know, Noah has, since I started the show, she's really developed a good taste in music. She's been on a big Taylor Swift kick lately, which is fine. But I'm going to recommend a song by the great country singer, songwriter Kacey Musgraves off her new album. It's called Deep. You love Kacey too?
Oh, I love her. This is like the most beautiful song ever.
Isn't this?
Zach.
Yes. Yeah. Like, so yeah, we talked about on the last episode, I talked about my family going to check out the solar eclipse. So, you know, the words of that day were totally like wonder and awe. And then we listened to this song on the way home from that. It's called The Architect, and it's off her new album, Deeper Well. And it's basically this song where she is like reveling in the majesty of the universe. And she says, she says, even something as small as an apple, it's simple and somehow complex, sweet and divine, the perfect design. Can I speak to the architect? And there's a canyon that cuts through the desert. Did it get there because of a flood? Was it devised, or were you surprised when you saw how grand it was? And so it's her, you know, talking to the architect, the creator, whatever you want to call it, about like, how did this incredible planet get to be so incredible? And so it's just a song that will make you feel the feels of Earth. Earth Day's coming up. I can't recommend Kacey Musgraves enough, but this song hits our whole family especially hard.
Ugh, I love her so much. So much. I mean, like the best. Deeper Well. Oh my God. Come on. Like that entire song is like, oh, the feels. Big feels. The feels.
Oh yeah.
In my house, we're in between Kacey Musgraves and Beyonce's country album. It's same. Like it's hit for hit. I mean, amazing. Yeah,
it's a good moment.
It's a country summer.
We're going to play this morning. Country I think summer. This will be our breakfast song. I love this.
Elizabeth, what have you got?
I am recommending reusable water balloons, which I wasn't really sure about, but we came across them at a like pool party here, and I immediately had to order some for like myself. So they're like
for yourself.
For me. They're for me. No, I mean, I feel like my kids are at a weird age in the pool. Like they love to swim, but they're like beyond the dive sticks, but they still like want to do something. And this is like the perfect thing for this age. So they're like, they clasp with a magnetic closure. So it's like two halves of a circle and you just like scoop the pool water and close them. And then when you throw them, you can actually kind of like play with them like a ball because they're a little bit hardy. But when they hit, they open and the water goes everywhere. So if you like playing on the grass or something, every time they hit the ground, they, you know, explode. They hurt the same amount as water balloons. So this is not like if you have a child that doesn't like to be hit by water balloons, they're not going to enjoy being hit by these.
Yeah.
But for my three, and like it's so fun, and we're playing with them as like balls in the pool, and it's kind of fun because sometimes when you catch them, they like open. They've just been like such a hit, and we can play with them on our small little deck without any of the, you know, balloon pieces that are everywhere, and I'm sure is bad for, you know, the earth, the creatures. So it's, I don't know, we're big fans of the reusable water balloons.
I love that.
All right.
Well, we always want to hear what you guys are loving, listeners. So seriously, please reach out and keep the conversation going. And that's our show. Please subscribe, leave a rating or review, and tell your friends. This episode of Care and Feeding is produced by Maura Curry. Shasha Leonard is the voice of our listeners. Alicia Montgomery is the VP of Slate Audio. For Lucy Lopez and Zach Rosen, I'm Elizabeth Newcamp. Thanks for listening.